Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org.
Hi, this is Mary Robson with Alex Henley. The last week before Thanksgiving, you heard it here. Today, we will share the second part of our lengthy interview with Robert Michael Pyle, more of his reflections on observing for nature. Bob, we're going to expand a little bit on what we have been doing by looking at some of your writing that people may not even know about. One of them is Where Bigfoot Walks, which is a wonderful read. And the other is a book you have in your hand that I can't read the title of, Over Where I Am. So will you just lead us into this?
Let's mention a little bit about Wintergreen.
And this is the book by which you are known by many, many people.
I think so. It was really my first non-butterfly book. I wrote it in 1980, well, in the early 80s, and it received the John Burroughs Medal in 87. Mm. And it's been in five different editions with three different publishers. And
Wintergreen, Rambles in a Ravaged Land.
Correct. And then for a couple of editions, it was called Wintergreen, Listening to the Land's Heart. But then we brought back the Rambles in a Ravaged Land because I live in an area in which logging is paramount. Now, Mary, I have two forestry degrees, and I know what my books are printed on. Mm-hmm. As Barry Lopez says, it's the flesh of the trees.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So I'm not anti-logging. I'm not anti-forestry. We're all part of the derivative fiber economy, whether we want to be or not. But mm-hmm. there's such a thing as good forest husbandry and bad logging that hurts the people of the woods just as mm-hmm. much as the woods. And that's really what Wintergreen was about. At first, some of my neighbors in Wakayakum County thought it was going to be an anti-logging book, and I got some rude salutes on the Jake breaks and things. But as people actually began to read it, some of them, they realized I was speaking for the community, mm-hmm. both the woods community and the people community, and I started having loggers come to my back door asking if they could buy the book. I've lived there for over 40 years now and never suffered too many slings and arrows for criticizing some of the practices that did end up diminishing the community when the unions were broken and the forests were reduced to pulp plantations. It's all private land. We have no national forest. And consequently, the Willapa Hills, which are the Coast Range south of the Olympics, have undergone a great deal of heavy, heavy logging again. We have managed to save the last bits of old growth in Willapa, but they're very small. Mm-hmm. And this book is about a future forest that may one day come. The spar pole is the great pole in the forest that used to be big trees, topped, and now they're big metal towers fitted with rigging to haul the logs up to the landing.
And so they've become, that term has become a mechanical piece of another way to snatch a tree.
Yes. Okay. They had to, when there weren't any more big tall trees, they had to bring in great metal booms instead for the spar pole, instead of an actual tree. It's a symbol of clear-cut logging on a large scale, but it's also a symbol of a way of life that is based on tree harvest, you know. Mm-hmm. So in giving us that name, Christ's idea was that this album will be something of a reconciliation, realizing that all people have a stake in the natural world all the way around. One of our hardest-hitting songs on the album is the eponymous ones. It's the name of our group is Butterfly Launches from Spar Pole. That's also the name of the album and the name of this particular song. And it's a rant, and it ends up at the end saying, but the forests will go on no matter what. Mm-hmm. So it's a vote for the future, and that's sort of what you're asking about in a way.
Yes.
It's necessary to set the scene first. Mm-hmm. So in Wintergreen, I set the scene for what it had been like, what it will be like.
Okay.
And here's how the Willapa Hills came about in a chapter called The Hills of Willapa. When one thinks about mountains, one thinks of significance. Mountains are about significance. Mountains sign the power of the ages to move and shift the very stuff of the earth. They signal the life of the land, since the stones are the bones of the beast that rolls in the rapture of orogeny. And mountains signify relief from the flatlands to anyone who as much as sights their heat-hazed forms across the monotonous miles of the plain. But as mountains go, the Pacific Coast Ranges are short on significance, and of the coast ranges, the Willapa Hills of southwest Washington are the most insignificant of all. So Wintergreen has read a love song to this insignificant, overlogged area, realizing, and Thunder Tree too, you know, these are books about the love of damaged lands. You can't throw the land away, not even Hanford, not even the Montlake dump at the university. You might as well love the damaged lands and make of them what you can. And to your question of what do we make of ourselves and our relationship to the rest of nature, it has to be, I think, ultimately, a recognition that it's not only the wilderness, but it's also the humble places and the damaged places that we must love, we must restore. We must claim as places where children can make their connection on the vacant lots, because what's less vacant to a curious kid than a vacant lot?
You know? I'm interested in the fact that you, in your time here in Port Townsend, have visited the Lost Wilderness recently discovered.
I couldn't say enough about it. I had a wonderful walk with Steve Bracer yesterday.
Well, I thought maybe you could tell us a little bit more about how that struck you and how it happens to be a place for trees to be safe but not protected at the moment.
I was extremely taken with the, as it is known now, thanks to Steve Grace and his fellow citizens, as the Quimper Lost Wilderness, a very sweet and small piece of our public land, state trust land on the Quimper Peninsula. It's a very beautiful wood that's completely devoid of non-native plants, with the exception of a little bit of holly, and I saw one bedstraw plant that might or might not be European or native, but there's no ivy in it at all. There's no broom. There's no Himalayan or Armenian blackberry. It's really quite connected in its, that's the problem with it. It's disconnected. It's fragmented. And a lot of big conservation thinks, well, we can't do much to protect this because it's already fragmented. But the fact is, although it's too small possibly to sustain some of the rarer birds and mammals, that's not the case with invertebrates. So when I founded the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation, this was exactly the sort of place we had in mind. These remnants where extremely diverse invertebrate populations can remain much better than the vertebrates can. And if we ever build this future forest that I write about in the song about butterfly launches from Sparpole, these will be the reservoirs of recolonization of the diversity of the plants and the invertebrate. The vertebrates can come after that from the big wilderness. So it remains a very important place, though it is fragmented. It's not protected because it's common school trust land that was slated for eventual harvest. It's just slightly miraculous.
One of the odder things about Washington State is that the lands that are due to be protected are said to be logged in the way of school funds.
I mean, that's a big one in Wakayakum County, my little county. It is always beggared for money. And I understand the commissioner's concern when a few more thousand acres are set aside for marbled murrelets. It does. And it does detract from, even though it's not considered a very good plan by the marbled murrelet people, it is considered a terrible plan by the county commissioners. So it's considered too much by some, too little by others. And Commissioner France, there's no way she can walk that line and happify everyone.
Well, and it has taken 20 years to get even to this point.
Well, exactly that.
And so I'm wondering about our local Quimper Lost Wilderness.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, fortunately, it has true old growth characteristics, in my opinion. And if it is deemed by the scientists in DNR to actually be a remnant old growth, then according to Steve, there's a real chance it might not be logged. Now, I sat for 8 years on the Natural Heritage Advisory Council, which actually advised the commissioner at her invitation. It was her, too, because it was Jennifer Belcher for much of that time. We advised on what pieces would become natural area preserves and NRCAs. My favorite committee I was ever on, because we really got a lot of conservation in. In the first four of those years, we actually had a fair amount of money and a bipartisan program to do it with. Now that program is under attack by various people. But that is one way in which the woods can be protected through a program called the Trust Land Transfer. And money goes from the general fund to buy land from the state that isn't appropriate for logging because it's special or it doesn't have very good logging value, but it has biological value. Sell it back to the state, in effect, as a preserve. And the money of the transaction goes through to the schools of the county just as it would if it was logged, if it were logged.
Which is complicated but appropriate.
Very appropriate. That's why it was bipartisan. Mm-hmm. And it worked out superbly for a number of years. Some of the people in state government have lost faith in it, but we need to build that back up again. Now, it doesn't mean that if we got a good appropriation for that this year, that this one would automatically be protected because there's a line. But if we could get it into the line, it would help to forestall anything.
I was wondering if you could describe the characteristics that you saw in it when walking in it that lead you to the thought of an old growth forest.
Yes. Well, in the first place, the plant community is complex, including the fungal. The invertebrate community is complex. The trees are not as large as old growth would be in Willapaw, where we have 150 inches of rain, because you have 20-some here, right?
Even less sometimes.
Or less.
Yeah.
So in the rain shadow, for the trees to be as big as they are, several feet in diameter, is stunning. They also have the thick, quirky, fissured bark on the Douglas firs that late cereal succession demonstrates.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to tell by the actual diameter. Need to be some actual tree cores. Need to be some studies of the burns on them to really get a sense of the actual age of the individual trees. But I had the sense, standing in the heart of the place, that I have had at Hendrickson Canyon in Willapaw, where we spent 20 years getting that protected. Jennifer Belcher's last act as Commissioner of Public Lands was to designate that one finally protected. I could stop lobbying her for all those years. And we did get it protected. And when I stand in the heart of that, I get the same feeling, although the scale's a little different, that I got standing in the heart of the Quimper Lost Wilderness. I really feel it does have late cereal stage old growth characteristics. Well, my greatest remaining hope and objective as a conservation activist is to see the establishment, the formal legal designation of a dark divide wilderness area. Now, I've been involved in monarch butterfly conservation for 50 years, the Highland Canal in Colorado, lots of other conservation efforts. I really choose my battles at this late age. but the one that I really hope to see resolved in the proper way is the dark divide wilderness. It's the largest remaining unprotected wild land in Washington. It's between Mount St. Helens and Mount Adams, immediately between the two, and it's between the Cispus drainage on the north and the Lewis drainage on the south. So it's between Mount Rainier and the Columbia and Adams and St. Helens. It's in that square, not far north of the Big Lava Bed and the Indian Heaven Wilderness, and not far south of the Indian Berry Fields, Tower Rock and all that. But it's 55,000 acres at a minimum, and with a little bit of road ripping, it could be 60-65 of federal wilderness quality land with old growth, noble fir, lots of it. And it's only protected now because of the Clinton Forest Plan, which again was imperfect, but it saved a lot of old growth after Slade Gorton tried to get it through the Timber Salvage Act. It was left out of the original Washington Wilderness Bill, left out of RARE 2, which was the next go-round. Then there was another Washington Wilderness Bill, and I remember lobbying Dan Evans for both the Indian Heaven and the Dark Divide, and we got the Indian Heaven, not the Dark Divide. But for a long time, the Forest Service called it amoeba, because it looked like an amoeba, because all the logging entrees.
Well, did they feel they could snatch all the edges?
Yeah, exactly. Nobody's going to set it aside if you call it amoeba. And so finally, Coalition of Environmentalists got the name changed to the Dark Divide, which is the name of the watershed divide, the Black Rock Ridge that runs between St. Helens and that very wild country, snagtooth, badger, shark, these wonderful sharp rocks. And it's the oldest Indian trail that we know of in the Cascades. It became the first Forest Service trail, boundary trail number one. But it's open to motorcycles, which damage it year by year. As we know, the federal roadless rule is under attack by the president. So that is why, one of the reasons, that I wrote my book called Where Bigfoot Walks Crossing the Dark Divide. It really is about Bigfoot, but it's about the entire ethic and thought and stories and legends, myths in the proper sense of the word, and the power of consequence that the Bigfoot stories have had for the Native Americans and later for the whites, and whether or not it's become just a tabloid joke in the present. No, I wasn't trying to find Bigfoot, prove Bigfoot, disprove it.
Well, and not only that, but the stories of a creature like this are worldwide.
Absolutely. And I go into all that in the book. And the newest edition, just out from from Counterpoint Press has a last chapter that brings all this up to date, and no less than Jane Goodall wrote,
"Oh my goodness,
I liked the book very much, only I don't know why you were so circumspect. To me, the evidence seems overwhelming." That's Jane Goodall.
Oh.
So I came out of this entire thing with an open mind, astonishingly, about its existence, even though that wasn't the question of the book. The question was, I'm a biologist and I'm a literary writer. No one with those attributes had tried to confront the whole Bigfoot question. Not the question, but the whole Bigfoot sensibility, and I did that with this book, published in 1995. The newest edition came out just last year.
I think it is less known than many of your other books, but it has a great deal that we need right now.
I think it's actually maybe the most substantial of my books in some ways, and it certainly deals with wilderness and in a way that comes from my heart. But I have various friends who say, I read all your books, but I won't read that, because they think it'll be silly. But here's what I hope will help. And this is a bizarre thing. This book is being made into a feature film right now. It's in post-production. It's already been shot. And it'll be released next spring.
By what authority or by what entity?
By an indie filmmaker by the name of Tom Putnam, and the producer of Napoleon Dynamite is the producer of this book. I'm played by David Cross. My late wife Tia is played by Deborah Messing. It's a substantial film, though it's on an indie budget, and it's going to go to the festivals this spring, and then we hope get it.
Well,
into
obviously,
the
then it will be in Port Townsend for the film festival September 2020.
I expect that it will be. But my hope, and the reason I bring it up, is that my hope for the movie is the same as my hope for the book, that they will help put a shoulder to the wheel to get this wilderness damn well protected. If it helps with that at all, it will have been worth it. Plus, it's just a fun and crazy thing in my life right now.
It must be diverting to be connected with. Are you writing the script, or is someone else writing it?
The script was written by a wonderful filmmaker who read the book. His name is Tom Putnam, and he's done Hollywood films, but he was most known for his documentaries, especially one called Burn about the Detroit Fire Department. Got all kinds of awards. Tom was a wonderful man, and he got the book. He knew the point of the book. I took him into the Dark Divide, said, Tom, I don't want a movie that's going to be a joke movie about Bigfoot. And that was never his idea. He was going to make it a documentary. And then as it grew, he decided, no, this needs to be a feature film. Some aspects are extrapolated and fictionalized somewhat from as they were in real life. But it's all based on real episodes that I had and encounters in the book, some of which he has extrapolated for dramatic effect. And I tell you, it's pretty funny. I got to go to some of the shoots and to watch these very talented actors playing myself and my late wife, Tia, bawling my eyes out, of course, seeing Deborah Messing as Tia, who was so respectful of her part.
This is something for every film lover and book lover in our listening area to consider. It's Where Bigfoot Walks. Yeah. I really hope
it's going to be called The Dark Divide.
A better, broader title.
And in
title,
fact, the whole Bigfoot
is,
theme is downplayed in the movie.
That is fascinating. We could go on and on.
We could.
We might go on and on.
Mary, thank you for your extraordinary attention to my work to share it with your listeners on this wonderful community radio station.
Thank you. The Lost Wilderness that Bob mentioned walking in has recently been certified as old growth and is being studied for preservation. That's it for this unusual version of Nature Now for today. We hope that you have enjoyed it, authentic and eclectic as usual. Nature Now repeats Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 5 p.m., and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m.
You can catch all of the shows of Nature Now on kptz.org. Thanks for listening.
They say the climate's changing, and that we know for sure. Villages fall into the Yukon as permafrost is melting. Walrus is stranded on icebergs. Polar bears paddling nowhere. Winter's worse and summer's like blazes and wildfires over the top. They say the climate's changing, and that we know for sure. Coral reefs are going south, and south, it's heading north. Butterflies cooking off mountaintops. deserts frying, jungles drying out. Oh, how could things be otherwise, the way we've carried on? Maybe carbon credits will do the trick, or a carbon tax instead. Maybe solar panels and windmills and energy-efficient nightlights will fill the bill. We can always hope for the best, but as fracking goes wild, tar sands tear up the taiga, 6 billion people go for 9, and gas back to $2 a gallon, I have my doubts. Oh, they say the climate's changing, and this we know for sure. And there's something else we know as well, that natural selection is still going on, and we might not be the fittest after all for what we've left behind. Evolution will mock our tardy rage when we figure all this out. Oh, it's been fun, this carnival of carbon, this festival of gluttony and greed. But it can't go on forever. Life, however, will go on, with us or without.